You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 425. Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cut-throughs, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed, in all of its forms, greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind. And greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Gordon Gekko, Wall Street.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by the Film Distribution Blueprint. If you want to avoid being taken advantage of by predatory film distributors, this is the course for you. If you want to check it out, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/letmein. Well, guys, today is the day. I have been teasing this episode now for a little while now, and you guys have been clamoring to find out who the special guest I have on the show today is. And a few of you guessed it, but if you don't know already, it is the legendary Oliver Stone. I cannot tell you how excited I am to bring you this interview. Talking to Oliver was like a dream come true because I am such a big fan and his films have had such an impact on me as a filmmaker, as a person, has made me think in different ways. He is such a unique filmmaker and artist. His films not only entertain, but they touch you. They make you think. They make you question many things about our society, about different areas of our society, from Wall Street to war to politics to the presidency. I mean, he's talking about huge, huge stories, huge figures in history. And he's just, there is really not a lot of other filmmakers who have a filmography like Oliver Stone. The films that he has been a part of, either as a screenwriter, producer, or director, have been nominated for 42 Oscars, and they have won 12. He personally has won 3 Oscars. His first one came as a screenwriter for the film Midnight Express in 1978. And then he tells the story about how even winning an Oscar as a screenwriter didn't guarantee anything. He was hustling for the next 5 years trying to get his movies made. He wrote Platoon and Born on the 4th of July in the 70s. And he was using Platoon as a writing sample to get him work on other little films like Conan the Barbarian, Scarface, and Year of the Dragon, which he all wrote. And they might be huge and monumental films today, but when they came out, they were not well received. So he had a really tough go of it. And then he had this amazing champion called John Daly, a legendary producer who gave him a shot to direct his script, Salvador. And then right from Salvador, he went into directing Platoon as this little independent film that he was shooting in the Philippines with a cast that if you look at today, you would be amazed at who was in that movie, but they were all just young actors, nobodies at the time. And his story is just so remarkable. He's worked on films, and I'm just going to throw a few of these films out that you might recognize from him. As I've already mentioned, Conan the Barbarian, Scarface, as screenwriters, and Salvador, Platoon, Wall Street, Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK, Natural Born Killers, Nixon, Any Given Sunday, Alexander, World Trade Center, W, Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, and the most recent, Snowden. I mean, his filmography is legendary. And I was truly humbled to sit and speak with an artist of his stature for an hour. I was just so, oh my God, it was just like I said, it was a dream come true. Now, I hope this conversation inspires filmmakers and screenwriters to never give up. Oliver struggled for years taking jobs as a production assistant, cab driver, office assistant, and any other gig he could find to help him survive while he was chasing his dream. He wrote and wrote, meeting his goal of 1 to 2 screenplays a year, no matter what. Oliver Stone is the definition of never give up and never surrender. And we also go into a deep dive of his new book, Chasing the Light, which is his memoir from the beginning of his career all the way up to the peak of Platoon, where he won 4 Oscars and was nominated, I think, for 8 Oscars that year. And his entire career exploded after that. And I have to highly, highly recommend his book because I've read it, and it is such an amazing, raw journey into Hollywood of that time, and then also just a peek into a career that is just remarkable. And I will give you links on how to purchase the book in the show notes at the end of this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Oliver Stone. I'd like to welcome to the show Oliver Stone. Thank you so much for being on the show, Oliver.
Nice to meet you, Alex. Frankly, I heard about you yesterday, and okay, here we are.
Yeah, I know. It's the fastest turnaround.
That's how I heard about you. I put up Facebook and or Twitter, and I forgot mm-hmm. which, and you answered, and you asked very nicely. Mm-hmm. First of all, that you were interested in the subject matter, which mm-hmm. was about nuclear energy, but the fact that you contacted and the invitation was very nice to join your show. So here I am.
And I appreciate it very much. Like we were talking a little bit before the show started, you know, I am a lot of the films in your filmography have had a major impact in my life. And because during the time when you were coming up in the mid to late 80s and early 90s, that time period was when I was working at a video store. So I was watching obscenely about so many movies, and that period of time you were prolific. I mean, you were shooting, you were making movies, a movie a year almost.
10 movies in 10 years.
Yeah, it was pretty insane. So it was like every year you would get, and every single movie you would do would be just like this monumental thing, from Platoon, Radio, Talk Radio, JFK, Born on the 4th, in Wall Street, and all those kind of films. So they were really impactful into my life. And I'm going to tell you something. When I saw Wall Street, because Wall Street really just immensely hit me in 87, 88, I can literally recite to you the greed speech. I learned it from my memory from that age, and I've never lost it. I'm not like I've been rehearsing it. It's just always stuck in the back of my head. And that character and what you did with that that film, the commentary that you were saying about things was remarkable.
Oh, the commentaries. Yeah, they were interesting. I used to really work at that. I cared about that. And a lot of people have noticed that the commentaries are pretty
pretty remarkable.
Pretty deep. And I like that because it's the only chance, you know, after the critics finish with you, dry you out in the laundry room, it's really nice to be able to say, hey, this is what I really intended. Maybe it didn't come across. But to be honest with yourself, and also it helps you creatively because it gives you feedback and says, okay, this, it gives you feedback and it gives you, makes you think about what you did and did not achieve. And often in the commentaries, I tried to be critical.
Now, you have a new book called Chasing the Light, right, which I'm a little bit over halfway through, and I love it so far, and I can't wait to finish the book. And I'm going to recommend it to everybody I know that is a filmmaker to read it. So I wanted to get started with the beginnings of your career, because the book takes you all the way up to Platoon, if I'm not mistaken, correct? To the end of Platoon. And you did a couple things after Platoon, just a few, not many, but you did a few other films after Platoon. But the story of how you came up is a story that I hadn't really heard about before from, I mean, Salvador and obviously Conan the Barbarian and Scarface and some of your older films as well. But the first question I have for you is, can you tell people, because I really think this is important, how many screenplays had you had written prior to directing your first film?
Well, no, I directed my first film out of film school basically 2 years afterward,
okay,
low budget horror film called Seizure, which
yes,
I wrote.
Uh-huh.
I had come out of film school in 71 with the, as a writer director in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I set out to be. That was my dream. And, you know, Godard and Buñuel and the European bag, the Italians too, Fellini among them. I mean, the obvious ones, but they were all leaders in the culture. And I wanted to be one. They were writer directors, most of them. And
mm-hmm,
that's what attracted me to the concept. And I had been a writer before film school. When I was 19, I wrote a book called A Child's Night Dream, which was eventually published in 97. But so the writing in me was always strong. But then after my service in Vietnam, I explained this in the book, as you know,
mm-hmm,
the intensity of that experience required a concentration at the highest level of your physical senses, smell, sight, sound. You walk in the jungle and, you know, you have to pay really 360-degree attention. That intensity in some way became the camera eye for me because I had never concentrated on the camera as much as I did there,
mm-hmm,
my camera, in my head. And that's what I tried to reproduce when I went to film school on the GI Bill, which paid my tuition there. But it was, you know, going out and making a short film is very chaotic for most of us. It's, you have to get the cooperation of all your fellow students. It's not easy. It's like a Chinese cultural critique session, you know. Each of us made films over that course of those 2 years. Some were successful, some were not. Short films are tricky, but, you know, there are an art form in themselves, and you learn a lot. You learn a lot physically, technically. You produce, you edit, you shoot, and you write. Now, most of the kids were not interested in writing. That was what was amazing to me. There was no requirement at film school to go to screenwriting class. No, none at all. That always bothered me because I went. I mean, maybe a few kids went, and I wrote screenplays during that period. And I learned from these teachers. They were good teachers. They were NYU teachers. And I bought a lot of screenplays, and I read them because they were becoming more available in the 60s. So you could read the screenplay, not from American movies as much as from European films. It's very interesting that, in a sense, the study of film starts with the Europeans. It was over the 70s it became more and more Americanized. And finally they started to publish some screenplays. But some of the greatest screenplays in American film, I have never seen any copies of them, except unless you go to the studio vaults. So there is a big hole there. And screenplays – the screenplay writer was regarded as kind of a worm in the back room, and the director was a star. He was wearing the scarf, Bertolucci, and he would come out on the set, and he'd make up his ideas as he went along. And there was a kind of free-form improvisation that was fun. It was the beginning of a new thing, and there was not the burden of money, the commercial feeling that you had to make your money back about that system, because these films in Europe were made for very little. So that was the environment in which – I always was I was disciplined as a writer. So after I got out of film school and drove a cab and worked in various jobs, got married, went through the whole hardship of trying to make it in the film business, which is very difficult, even in those days, far more perhaps. And in that period, I kept writing screenplays. Every year I set a goal for myself of at least trying to write one and a half, maybe two screenplays and a couple of treatments to turn out stuff, sending them out to agents. No response, rejections. So you say how many? I don't really remember. I would say about 8 to 11, as well as long treatments. One of those treatments, the cover-up, was my first break. It sold, option sold, almost made. And I got to work with Robert Bolt, who was a great screenwriter of that time, in Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
Bolt was a serious student, but he was of the style of screenwriter that you lay it all out on the page. The architecture is there. Every line of dialogue is there. It's a whole other way, different than film school, so where you're writing more of a treatment. So I was always between the two. I was trying to write the full-out screenplay, and at the same time I was – and when I became a director finally in the business in 85 with 86 with Salvador and then Platoon, I stayed true to this screenwriter loyalty, which is write the script, write it as much as you can, give on paper before you do it. And I have that mindset. And I think a lot of people underrate that, don't make much of it.
Right. And then so your second film was The Hand, which was with Michael Caine, and it was a horror film. And I always found it interesting that you started your career as a director with two genre films, essentially, horror movies. Can you tell me how The Hand came around?
Well, The Hand is very similar to The Hand's an interesting movie. It's going to be actually re-released by Shout Factory next year on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
it was buried at the time. I like the movie. I saw it recently, and it's kind of – it's very interesting psychological thriller based on a book I bought by Mark Brandel called The Lizard's Tale. But it was very similar to Seizure because it's a similar story in that the main character, Jonathan Frid in the first one, Michael Caine in the second one, are haunted people, haunted in the sense that they bring with their minds, they bring the doom onto themselves. They think the horror. And, In the case of The Hand, he thinks his wife is leaving him, and he becomes insanely jealous. And he sees everything as that he loses his hand in the car accident. He sees it partly as her fault. He sees the hand ultimately as a weapon of vengeance, a weapon of anger, mm-hmm. to get back at the people who took his hand as well as his wife. So it's pretty far out and very ambitious as a first movie. Very difficult to make a small hand work as a shark might. And I was crazy to do it, but that was a kind of, it was, you know, difficult for me. Prior to The Hand, you forgot that I came through as a screenwriter in 1977-78 with Midnight Express.
Which is my next question.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So Midnight Express actually was – do you consider Midnight Express to be the project that really launched your career?
Yeah. I mean, it got me into the Hollywood side of the business. I was in New York. I was dead in the water. I tried. You know, to get all these rejections, I mean, I got hundreds of letters. It's no fun.
Right.
I mean, going begging for things, getting small jobs, a production assistant here and there. TV work. I worked for almost a year, well paid, in an advertising film company for baseball films. I mean, I trying to make it happen. My wife, thank God, was working at the UN and had a steady job. So that was, you know, we made ends meet. And I have to say, I almost gave up hope many times. By the time I reached 30 years old, I talk about it in the book. Mm-hmm. At 30 years old, you feel like in those days, you feel like you had to have started your career. You know, if not, something was wrong. And I felt like I had failed in my life. And I go into that and why. And my father, my mother, my grandmother, all this comes into play. So that's why I ended the film with Platoon, because when I ultimately realized my dream, which was to have a success of international proportions that are unbelievable. I mean, every country in the world had played, made big money, number three in America domestically. And then on top of it, Academy Awards. And then it wins. Elizabeth Taylor's out there on the stage giving me a big kiss. You know, she was this, the movie star of my youth as a woman. She was the most glamorous. So, you know, this was all unbelievable. And but I had been so it was a golden time. And that's why I wanted to end the book, because that the dream had been achieved. And I showed you how it was achieved and how much work was required, how much rejection. And I think it'd be very helpful to young people, I thought, to to see the path that we had, or I had in the 1970s. It's different now because in many ways it's a different system, because now it's a lot technically easier to make a film. You don't have to kill yourself. It's much easier to turn out quality with the video camera, and it's up to you. It's much more inventive medium, and techniques are much, much easier. However, you have the consequent problem that if everybody's doing it, you have a huge volume and a limited distribution system.
Right, right, exactly. It's a lot easier to make the movie. Now the place you have to kill yourself is actually get anyone to see it or sell it.
Exactly, exactly. I've seen so many young filmmakers have sent me stuff. I have piles of films that nobody watches. You know, it's really, and there's some talent here, some talent there. Talents, but I've championed many films that have filmmakers that have gotten some distribution, but it never worked out. I mean, they died off in the end. Very hard to get through this barrier of distribution and publicity.
Now you talk about championing filmmakers. Can you talk a little bit about what John Daly did for you as a champion? Because we all need a champion, especially in this business, if we can get one.
I dedicated the book to John. I mean, the book for me took 3 years to write off and on. It's just a lot of work. I have to tell you that it's like making a movie in its own way. And I take writing very seriously in the sense of I just not scribbling out, I did this, I did that. No, I'm looking for themes in the book. The themes of growing up, themes of going to war, the themes of relationships with your parents, your mom and your dad, your grandparents, the history of that time, what was going on, World War II into Vietnam. And I think there's a lot of consequences out of World War II. I was born at the end of it in 46. And my mother was a French citizen. My father met her on the street in Paris during the liberation, and as an officer in the army, and married her and brought her back to the States in late 45, early 46, pregnant. So there you go. I mean, I'm a war baby, you'd say, right? Mm-hmm. French. You know, my mother was an immigrant in her way.
But John is
also an immigrant. I mean, I've always done well with immigrants. For some reason, the American movie business was just not letting me get my stuff done. It was so frustrating. By the time I made The Hand, I was, even with the success of Midnight Express, I was kind of a black sheep. People knew me as outrageous, somebody who broke barriers, who was trying to say things, do different things, was fighting for this Vietnam script that everybody said, hey, yeah, it's well written, but we don't want to make it. It's not going to make any money. So, I mean, there was kind of the guy who was one of those guys around that was known as difficult, or not that I was crazy, but I really was upset that things were not going. I wrote a script called Born the 4th of July and a platoon in the 70s. Right. And neither one could get made. It was just frustrating because here they were making Apocalypse, Coming Home, Deer Hunter, nice films, but nothing to do with my experience on the ground over there. They're both the mythic films. Coming Home, very realistic, but about a woman in a marriage in L.A. The other two were gigantic films, but they have nothing to do with reality that I saw. Hmm. I could say that, you know, Michael Cimino, I worked with him on Year of the Dragon, a big vision, Napoleonic vision, but reality, not so much. And so Francis, also the Godfather.
But John was the one. But John was the one that kind of.
Well, it's just that I was kind of dead in the water. I wrote Scarface, and it, you know, although it's acclaimed as a now, at that time it had a hard road. It was, I had fight with the producer, and he badmouthed me and around the business. And frankly, it was filled with obscenity and violence, and people thought I was crazy. Kind of, I'd done Midnight Express, Scarface, Conan the Barbarian. These were tough, violent films, so people saw me as some kind of the Hand. You know, who is this guy? So it was tough, and I had to. I left LA, and I talked about my cocaine addiction too. So that was a big problem at one point, but I gave that up. And then I fought my way back with You're the Dragon with Cimino. Didn't do as well as they'd hoped. So my career was dead. And I said, I can't do it the Hollywood way, the LA way. So I'm going to do it this way. I was in New York at that. I had moved back to the city. And I really set out to do Salvador, which was a gigantic film. Again, I'm crazy. Set in a Civil War country in 1980s. We started in 85. A journalist I knew, Richard Boyle, a wonderful, wonderful friend, Irishman, had been there and had a whole story with the death squads down there and with a woman. And he'd written about it in his notes. And I took that and with him made it into a screenplay. And I dedicated myself to making this movie at any cost. I would not quit until we made it. I was going to use my own money. I had, at that point, I accumulated some money from screenwriting, so I had enough to maybe get a bigger loan at the bank. I had a couple of houses that I owned, and so forth and so on. So I was scheming to make this film for $700,000. Now, this involves helicopters, it involves Civil War, it involves involves death squads. But Boyle was so sure that we would get cooperation from Salvador, which is a very cost-wise, very inexpensive country to shoot in, but they never shot a film. So it was insane proposition. It shows you how desperate I was, but I wouldn't give up. And I wrote the script with him, and it was a good script, but nobody wanted to touch it because, again, it was critical of the U.S. foreign establishment. Oh, God, I've just been so many rejections in my life. I can't. I have about 10,000 now, I think. You know, I'm sick of it. I'm good at rejection.
But you can't.
Something of mine the other day, important to me, and I kind of shrugged. It just doesn't end, rejection. I mean, I think that's the best advice I can give. John Daly was introduced to me as an English independent film. He'd just come to Hollywood. He was making his first steps. He was doing a film with the Falcon movie with Sean Penn, and he was doing, he'd been involved with Terminator, the first one, but had had problems with Cameron and him, had not gotten along and blah, blah, blah. And also he was involved with...
Okay, so many. It's hard to keep track.
He was doing the. He'd done a nice job with the Gene Hackman movie.
Yes.
Gene Hackman with the basketball movie.
The Hoosiers.
Hoosiers. I love that movie. And so he was trying to make good films. He had some taste. Although he was not known for it, he was a boxing promoter in Africa doing the Ali fight, one of them. And he had a shady reputation and so forth and so on. But he was a lovely scoundrel. I loved him because he was a Cockney. He was unpretentious from the lower classes. And he didn't have any respect for the establishment. So he was that kind of guy. He read Salvador and he read Platoon. I swear this is a true story. You never hear it. Very rare story. But he read both. I went in to see him. By the way, I met him through Gerald Green, who those people who care. Gerald Green was another character. They were both kind of con men, but they were nice. They were good guys, but they were scraping by. And I sat in that meeting, and John said to me, "God, bloody hell, the good scripts, both of them. Which one do you want to do first, Oliver?" That's a piece of it's a classic dialogue because you just don't never hear that shit.
Never.
No. No one says yes like that. No one says – they all say maybe and then they forget about or they all say no, but they don't really know what they're talking about. So anyway, I said, I want to do Salvador because it's fresh, it's new, and I'm not going to do Platoon because I almost made it three times and it got destroyed on the way. It never get made. It's a cursed – it's a fucking cursed film. So here, Salvador. So I started on Salvador, and he actually helped me get it made. And it was some road. It's in the book. It doesn't end there. There were so many problems making that film. Jimmy Woods was great, but also an extremely prima donna and at that time. And I've become great friends with him, but my God, he made this, he made the road. He was the star of the film. And, anyway, we pulled it together with about $4 million, $3 million. And the money was always questionable. You never knew if it was going to show up the next day, that kind of movie. It was so paced. It was pasted together. And you know what? It works. Go see it again. Mm-hmm. Please do.
No, it's a fantastic film. There's a rawness to it. It's so raw and it's so visceral. It is remarkable. All right, so then you do Salvador, and then
that
I get
– That almost killed me.
Right. You know, and then you just jump into another small movie.
90 speaking parts, right. Civil War, helicopter battles, all kinds of shit, tank battles. But we got it. We somehow finished it, and we ran out of money several times. It's a great story. Then John says to me, and we have fights all the way through the editing because John is concerned about the violence and there was any length and all. I had all the usual issues. Big vision, 3 hours. I had to cut it down to 2 hours and 10, and the violence. Oh God! They rejected it. Every fucking studio distributor in Hollywood rejected that movie. That was heartbreaking. It was good. It was a good movie, but too much violence, too much.
At the time.
Anyway, So what does Daly do? He says, fuck him. I'm going to make my own distribution company. And he did. He made this Hemdale distribution company. And he literally distributed the film himself in April of 86. It doesn't open. I mean, he doesn't have any money to really distribute it, but at least it gets on the map and there are some decent reviews. There are people begin to see it and they get excited about it, but it takes time. Meanwhile, he says, go make Platoon in Philippines. So I'm going from Mexico right to Philippines with $6 million now. And Platoon's a big movie, but again, I've been through the rough road now with my cinematographer, Bob Richardson, and Bruno and various people and Alex Ho. So we made the movie at $6 million more efficiently than we did Salvador because we were more experienced and we had all the usual problems of a jungle and heat and sticky and rain and all that shit. It wasn't easy, but we plowed through it because we were tough. And lo and behold, I mean, it really took off. I can't tell you how it took off right away. I mean, the moment there was a nothing movie. We were in a B film in the Philippines, sort of a Chuck Norris thing or something. Nobody gave a shit. And, you know, the moment we showed it, it was cut in a rough cut. People started reacting. And, gee, oh, my God, I've never seen anything like this. It's a reality that they had never seen before. A reality, because I had gone into the details of what I had experienced. And that was missing from war films in general. I've seen a couple that are close, Korean war films, but at that time, now it's almost standard they do it, but it was hard to get the reality of the jungle and the perception of the jungle. And on top of it, it was critical. It was critical of the whole experience, which I think was the best part of it. It was a message saying this thing is a fraud. This thing, the whole fucking war was a fraud. There were three lies I mentioned in the book. I go into the details, you know, the concept of friendly fire, Americans being killed by their own fire is much greater than people know. The concept of killing civilians in Vietnam was huge. I mean, it was very abundant and not always, but there was a lot of that going on and accidentally spillovers and stuff like that. And number three, the biggest lie of all was that we're here to win. We're here winning. And that was never true. From the beginning, it was never true. From 1947 on, it was never true when we got involved with the French. So there's a lot of lying going on. And I go back into the concept, the theme of the lie and how the lie influences American life. Because my parents had lied so much to me at the age of 16, they rip apart. And I think we are the happiest family in the world. But no, it's not true. What's going on? Boom. Here's what's happening. Lie, lie, lie. This is what I learned in my life, that people lie. And not necessarily out of malicious intent, but out of comfort or out of fear, various reasons. So that lie, which extends from the divorce in 62, extends into Vietnam for sure, because that's all I see. I come back to the United States alive, fucked up. a lot of Vietnamese dope over there. Mm-hmm. But I learned a lot from the black troops because they were into the music. I learned a lot about life, humanity, staying about love in a way. It's an interesting story. That's a side story. I got into some of that in Platoons. Some of the Charlie Sheen's best friends are black in that movie. They kept me human. I stayed closer to the, and the character of Elias by Willem Dafoe is very important too. He becomes a figurehead for the young man. You see him at the end of the war. He's divided, very divided. He's a man of two fathers. He says the two sergeants represent polar opposites. And one sergeant kills the other. That's the crux of the movie. Is one sergeant after he's reported for a war crime, but the other sergeant kills that sergeant under the cover of battle, under friendly fire, and gets away with it, except that the young man sees it, and he has to get even. And it leads to its denouement, which is pretty strong, where you know what happens. I mean, it doesn't that kind of stuff doesn't get shown in war films. It's, if you look at the rest, even the ones that followed, it's generally speaking, to get the cooperation of the Pentagon and the movie studios and all that, you got to go along with the patriotic, or the United States really cannot be criticized for any of its wars. Now, considering that we've lied our way into 6 or 7 wars since World War II, I think the intelligence agencies have lied to us so much, and the lie persists in American life. This is a theme for me. Obviously, you see it in JFK, and you see it in you see it again and again and again. Snowden, my last one in 2016. I guess I'm the director who seeks out the lies.
And exposes them. And that's something that you've been – that's since the beginning almost.
I can't help it. And don't believe me, it's gotten me in a lot of hot water.
I could only imagine. Well, Oliver, I can only imagine. Now, after the massive success of Platoon, box office success, and you know Oscars and awards and all that kind of stuff, you go into – in my opinion, a decade-defining film, which is Wall Street. It really captures a segment of what the 80s were like for people who wanted to kind of feel what it was like to be there at that time. And I feel that that's something that you do with a lot of your films. You define the era so beautifully, like with The Doors and JFK.
I just set out to tell the story in the best style I could. I was able to get better and better at filmmaking, and it's all about experience. You know, I'm no genius, and I sat with my crew, with Bob and Bruno and Alex. We set a style for each film that worked for that film. In other words, JFK was done in a very specific style for that story, as was Natural Born Killers. And so was and Wall Street was done this way. Born on the 4th of July was very, very hard and almost cinemascope vision of reality, linear story. We made it linear. The book was not. So each film, I was never thinking about this is defining something. I think a lot of my work since then has also defined for me new things. But if people don't see it yet, they will one day. I've gotten more and more into documentaries. I've done 9 or 10 now, 8 or 9, including the Untold History of the United States is, I think, one of my strongest efforts. It was done in 2012, and it was 12 hours long. It was the history of untold history of this country from 1898 to 2012 with Mr. Obama. Please see it. If you haven't seen it, you have to see it.
I highly recommend it. I highly, highly recommend
it. Have
you seen it? Yeah, I saw it when it came out back in the day. And I
see it again.
Yeah. I know.
You got to pay attention.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, when you were making Wall Street, you worked at the Paris Mercantile Exchange when you were a teenager? Is that correct?
So how'd you know that?
Well, I do a little bit of research. And is that one of the things that kind of drew you to that story? What made you make Wall Street? Because there's so much passion behind there.
Yeah, I worked on the cocoa and sugar exchange in Paris one summer. And my father was on Wall Street for most of his life, from 1930s on, 1932-33. Right. Four in that area. No, at four he became a floor walker in the Depression, and then he became a stockbroker, an analyst. In those, he worked his way up. It was the old system. He was the Hal Holbrook character in a sense, or the Marty Sheen character from Wall Street. He was the old fashioned values, the way, do it the right way. Wall Street for him was a serious religion. It was the engine of American business. And I mean, he meant it seriously, because it was, Wall Street was where you would go to get money. You would go to capitalize your business for research and for capitalization. I mean, it's very important to build companies. It was his idea of America. It was building. And he saw Wall Street as the most positive factor, which I believe it was for many people. Although, obviously, there's some privilege and abuse. Some people take advantage of it to more. But my father was a good man, and I don't think he was – money was not his goal. It was about his – he was an intellectual. He wrote monthly letters. So he really cared about this. He would have – he would, if he had lived past 85, he would have been, I think, surprised to see a Gordon Gekko type. When I made the movie, the business was changing. I had friends who were making millions of dollars at that age, at a young age, my age, on Wall Street. Well, actually, I was at that time. I was actually 43. So I'm saying people were making money in their 30s, in their some in their late 20s. This was unheard of in my father's day.
Oh, right.
Now, and of course, it was revealed. A new business was revealed. The concept of businessmen like Gekko going into companies and getting their stockholders to vote for them and breaking up these companies and, in some cases, cannibalizing them. That is to say, taking businesses like big business and take a subsection of it and sell it off, cannibalize it. That's what he does in the movie. Charlie Sheen's father is a union rep. Is a union rep at the airline. He runs the union. I'm sorry.
No worries.
Ignore that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Blue Star. Blue Star, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he takes over on a tip from Charlie that was given to him. He takes advantage of the naivete of Charlie, Michael Douglas does, and he buys into the company. It's one of his many things he's doing. He buys into the company and eventually gets control of it and then breaks it up, destroying so many jobs. And I showed that, the pain of that, and I think that's important. And the father feels betrayed by the son. The father has a heart attack. The son understands the scope of his mistake, which is huge. So many people get hurt, and all his life, he repents. He gets to this place. You'll see what happens in the movie. He changes, and he goes after Gekko, reveals him to the SEC, and takes the fall. He himself takes the fall. He gets involved. He gets to go to jail, and presumably he's learned his lesson and comes out of jail, and he'll be a good man, a better man. That's a true story. It happened a lot. But the surprise of the movie, of course, was that, first of all, they didn't want to make that either, because who cares about business? There were not many business movies before that were serious. Mm-hmm. This was. And they distributed it very weirdly. It's a whole story there. I'll write about it in the next book. Mm-hmm. But it actually hung around, and it made money over time. It became a big cult favorite, and more than that, it became it affected a lot of young people who went into Wall Street. Some of them I've met since then. Some of them made fortunes on Wall Street. They owe me
a small commission.
In a way, I was my father's continuation, because he was a broker, made money for people, not himself. The shock was that Michael Douglas, who was the supporting character, the bad guy, so to speak, becomes the star of the movie in people's minds, and of course wins the Oscar.
I know.
The film doesn't get nominated for anything, not even for screenplay. And there are many witty lines in it, but no, it went to Michael, and Charlie went his own way in his own career, and I think he was a talented young actor. Mm-hmm. But you know where he went. He went into girls and money, but He was the first part of the film. I don't think he was the second part.
Fair enough. Now, let me ask you, what do you hope people take away from your life's work?
I have no such intention. I make the films to satisfy an inner need, and I try to make it as broad and entertaining as possible. Okay. But you can never tell. People walk away from Wall Street, oh, man, I'm studying engineering and science, and I'm going to drop that. I'm going to go to Wall Street and make a fortune. That wasn't the intention.
No, exactly.
So you can never – often a box office success is a misunderstanding between the audience and the author.
Mm-hmm. All right. Fair enough. Now, what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business in today's world?
I would just do it the same way. I would write, direct myself. I would take – a limited amount of money, and I would make the most creative, imaginative film I could, because you have easier tools, less money is involved. I wouldn't necessarily do it on an iPhone unless I had to, but mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying. You can make the film. The question, of course, is how good is it and will it be distributed? That's a tough game. And in that regard, I can just say show it. Show it at the right places. A lot of people take the film festival route, which is pretty long and hard because there's so many film festivals now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got to do what you got to do to show it, to people to show it. I would add a few layers to that. I would mm-hmm. say if you can afford it, go to acting school.
Yes.
Study drama. Mm-hmm. Study writing. Acting is very important. I took a try at it. I wasn't very good, but you must watch actors. You must understand them to some degree. And by going to acting class and seeing the fundamentals, how they're formed, how people shape the characters, and some succeed, some don't, you see a lot. So that's a very important thing. And a sine qua non. Okay?
You can't do it. Fair enough.
And also writing, obviously, keep writing. Write a diary. Write about incidents in your life. Write about take it and translate the personal onto paper. Now, on paper, it's a whole other ballgame. This happened. It was searing. It was violent. It was this. It affected you. But now, is it here on paper? And that's another transfer of energy. It's what it's about.
Okay. Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
And read. I'm sorry.
And read lots, and not just film books.
See plays. Yeah. See, you know, the structure of plays and movies. Oh God, I saw how many movies. You forget movies. That's the problem. In movies, you have to see more than once to really absorb them. As you know, you've probably seen all the junk movies 3-4 times.
I've seen a few junk movies. I've seen a few healthy movies.
I bet you missed Frogs.
I did miss Frogs. Yes, I have not seen Frogs.
You didn't see Frogs. Okay.
I did not see Frogs.
Check it out. AIP 1974-5. It's a great movie. It scared the shit out of me. I've never go back to horror films since then, except for one, The Witch. That broke me up too. I can't see horror films anymore. That's why I didn't succeed in horror films, because I was too much of a masochist, and I was always turning the horror was going inward into the guy's head. So. To be a horror filmmaker, you have to be sadistic to some degree. You have to want to nail the audience like Hitchcock did or De Palma.
Now, the lesson that took you the longest to learn.
You were asking me about something else. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the business or in life?
Barbara Walters' time here.
If you were a tree, Oliver, what kind of tree?
Longest to learn. To love.
Okay. It's a great answer. Great answer. Now, where can people purchase your book, Chasing the Light? Everywhere?
I'm just kidding.
No, you can't. It's not enough.
For all I know, it's on Amazon. It's on iTunes, wherever you check for your books. That's obviously the place to go. There are good bookstores in New York and L.A. and I guess in Texas somewhere. Mm-hmm. But there might be I'm sure I've heard it's in New York. The distribution in LA, I don't know, it's spotty. This COVID thing has ruined so much. Mm-hmm. So many books have opened flat. You know, the book is doing well in spite of that. And it's there is an interest in it. And I think it's a good biography, but you can always get it somewhere.
And when can we expect the sequel? And when can we expect the sequel? The next one?
I haven't in my head. I have diaries. It'll take a year or two. It's a long story. It's a hard story. It doesn't end in 86. It's a great high, and it's the realization of a dream, and it's the end of an act in your life, so to speak. You arrive. I was 40 years old, and I was I was on top of the world, just feeling good. But it's a hell of a load to carry, is success. You don't have any idea how many people hit on you or need things from you. And all of a sudden you're growing and your circle is growing and you have so many people in your life. It's a whole other ballgame.
And can I ask you one last question? throughout your career, you have worked within the studio system. Finding money here and there in the studio system. How do you work within that system and still maintain the creative fight that you have in all of your work and fight for that vision?
You have to do it step by step. There is no formula. Mm-hmm. Thing is, I did enter into the studio system. You can't say Platoon or Salvador were done inside that system. No, they were not. They were independent films. And they were recognized by the independent spirit people. But after that, yes, I had an entree. And Wall Street, yes, was made by Fox, 20th Century Fox, under Rupert Murdoch and Barry Diller. You have to realize I always did what I wanted to do. I never, except for once or twice where I was compromised by a studio head, I managed to always do it my way. It was my script or I co-written, or even if my name is not on it, believe me, it was my story. It was something I had totally put my stamp on. It never worked for me. I never got scripts from the studio. It never worked. They'd say, are you interested in this or that? Sometimes it was a very big commercial film, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't get myself into it. Because a commercial film, in their minds, an action film, has to have a climax every 15 minutes or an action scene. And that's you're putting a shape on it right away. You know, Tom Cruise has to run here and he has to do that. And after 15 more minutes, it fucks you up. You got to do it. I found my way through it. Talk radio was done independently again with Garth Grabinski in Canada and Ed Pressman. The film then was followed by Born on the 4th of July was done under difficult conditions with Universal, limited money. But Cruise was a movie star, and it was a story about a paraplegic. So obviously they're not too keen on seeing Tom Cruise in a wheelchair for half the movie. You know, you understand these kind of problems come up. Always fighting about it. JFK, I sold it as a thriller. I sold it to Warner Brothers. They loved the idea. It's a murder story. They didn't think about, nor did I, of all the political implications of saying this. Mm-hmm. So, but I had no doubt that I was following a true path of Jim Garrison, who had started this horrible investigation that shocked the world, but he actually stuck to his guns. He was the first public figure, a DA in New Orleans, who actually did that. Nobody else opened their mouth about that awful crime that was buried in the bullshit of the Warren Report. Mm-hmm. Garrison had tremendous guts and paid a huge price. That kind of thing. Nixon was done from inside me, so made by Warner Bros. Wouldn't make it. It was made by an independent, Andy Vanya. Mm-hmm. Independent. Doors was made independent with Mario Casar. Right. You see, I would go back and forth. These were independent producers became empowered in the 80s from video sales. That was the whole difference. We had video sales. And that group of people, Dino De Laurentiis was one of them, but Mario, Andy, John Daly, they were able to carve out a little kingdoms and Harvey Weinstein out of these video sales. And that became a business until it became abused, as all these things do. The numbers changed. And by the late 90s, the middle 90s, the numbers were insane. And people were expecting too much. It's always the golden goose, you know. Video sale. And then we mark up the prices and we say it's worth this much. And it changes, it distorts. And actors started asking for $15, $20 million a picture. It all changed and became more corporate. And that's what happens. The corporations move in because the money is bigger. And these independent producers start to disappear. You can track the flow of them through mm-hmm. time. And a lot of them disappear because the studios or the corporations take over that business.
Right. Well, Oliver, I appreciate your time so much. Thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you for being you all these years. Yeah, thank you very, very much for that. And I recommend the book highly for everybody to read. So thank you. And well, please.
The question is, are you going to finish it? Because
it's right here.
I won't finish it.
Oh, no, I will. I will. I love books like this. And your writing in the book, I can feel like I'm there. And that's such a wonderful experience. And you're here, and I'm hearing stories. Look, I'm a movie geek. So all these kind of stories I love listening to. and the inside stuff of stuff. And I, when I picked up the book, I expected to be like, you know, this is an Oliver Stone book. If it's anything like his movies, he's going to be raw and he's going to tell the truth. And that's exactly what I've gotten so far as I've gotten in the book. So I really do appreciate you putting this book out. And I hope this book and this show inspires many filmmakers and screenwriters out there. So thank you so much for your time, sir.
Remember the lie.
The lie is the theme. Thank you, my friend. Merry Christmas.
It's a line of dialogue in Nixon, by the way.
Yeah, of course.
And Nixon says it. It's a great scene. Okay, take care of yourself, Alex.
All right, my friend. Thank you again.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Pat.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank Oliver Stone so much for coming on the show and sharing his filmmaking journey with the tribe. As I promised, this was going to be a legendary episode of the Indie Film Hustle podcast, and I hope I did not disappoint you guys. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to read Oliver's new book, Chasing the Light, Writing, Directing, and Surviving Platoon, Midnight Express, Scarface, Salvador, and the movie Game, all you have to do is go to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/425. And if you want to get a free copy of the audiobook, just head over to freefilmbook.com and sign up for a free trial of Audible, and you can download Oliver's book for free and listen. I will also put that link in the show notes. As a filmmaker, Oliver Stone really loves to stir up controversy. He is a larger-than-life figure. And again, such a unique filmmaker that was able to play and still is able to play within the studio system, but many times is much more at home outside the studio system, working with less money and making independent films. And again, I hope this interview inspires filmmakers and screenwriters out there to never give up and never surrender their dreams. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.